American Forests has been restoring forests for more than 140 years. Since 1990 alone, they have planted nearly 60 million trees in forest restoration projects in all 50 states. Their impact? Recovering hundreds of thousands of acres of wildlife habitat, safeguarding watersheds, absorbing millions of tons of greenhouse gases, and protecting some of America's most stunning landscapes. They are all on the list of their accomplishments. American Forests envisions a world in which forests are thriving and valued for their significant environmental, societal, and economic benefits. Hello, I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And it's going to be a great show today on so many levels, and one of them is personal for me. This is a show about good news. When I was doing the show prep, I'm like, let's ask him this, let's ask him that. So our guest today is Jad Daly. He's the president and CEO of American Forests, and he is up to quite a lot. We're going to find out about how this organization establishes priorities for the work, given the increasing reality of the impact of climate change. With so many needs out there, as the planet continues to warm, where do they choose to focus and why? And I'm going to ask Jad about impact. How does the work they do impact our climate, our wildlife, our water, and our people? So, Jad, get ready for lots of questions and I'm sure lots of powerful answers. And what an honor and pleasure it is to have you here today. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so I just have to do a very quick connect the dots. How you came to be here was just meant to be. We were at Green Biz with Joel McCower, who I absolutely adore, in Phoenix earlier this year. And Kelly, our show producer, was sitting next to Pat Graham, who is the head of the Nature Conservancy here in Arizona, and they're doing incredible work. And he had just done a great show with us for our local show. And one of your staff was sitting next to him, which is no surprise. And I quote, he was raving about being on our show. Not hyperbole, I'm hoping. And the woman said, wow, you have to get our CEO, Jad Daly, on your national show. So that's how the green dot got connected. I'm really glad that it did.
Me too.
Okay, so can we start with just a big picture overview of the important work of American Forests and take all the time you need, because it's clearly not a soundbite. And your areas of focus are all so vitally important. I mean, I went down the rabbit hole on your website, and you've got it covered.
Oh, I so appreciate that. Well, in 144 years of looking out for America's forests, we have racked up quite a number of accomplishments and created a really broad and substantial role for ourselves in taking care of America's forests. So I appreciate your invitation to walk folks through the whole of that. You know, when I describe American forests, one of the places I like to start is our vision. We have a vision for healthy and resilient forests across America, from cities to wilderness. And that has never been more important, but yet never more challenging, for both important for all the things that forests do for us that at this moment in time tie to our greatest societal needs. And our most urgent challenges. But we also have unprecedented work to do to create healthy and resilient forests. There's never been more stress on our forests than there is right now, and that's really being driven by climate change. Climate change is supercharging what have in some cases been traditional stresses on our forests, like tree diseases and wildfire. And it's just taken them to an entirely different level, where our forests are in many cases overwhelmed by these stresses. And so they really need organizations like American Forests and our many partners across the country, ranging from the U.S. Forest Service and other government agencies to fantastic tree planting and tree care organizations in cities and rural communities across America. And so we like to think of ourselves as a servant leader at the middle of that movement to care for America's forests, bringing those kinds of diverse partners together and identifying, you know, what do our forests need from us right now? What do our forests need us to do in order to help them weather climate change. And so we think getting that right involves bringing together three things. The first is science. We really need science more than ever to act as our essentially our crystal ball for looking into the future and understanding what are the conditions going to be like for our forests, not just right now, but 20 years or 50 years or 100 years from now. And so how do we manage our forests today in a way that they're going to remain resilient even as the conditions continue to change rapidly around them thanks to climate change? So we really need to get the science right in the way that we take care of our forests. The second piece of the puzzle from our perspective is forestry. Forestry, the act of how we engage with our forests, whether it's replanting our forests through reforestation or whether it's how we manage forests, for example, to thin them so they're less prone to wildfire, has never been more important as a way to help our forests weather the stresses that they're facing and when we do lose forests, to replace them by replanting them. And so the way that we think about it is we need to take what we learned in science and connect that into the work of forestry that's being done all across the country by our organization and by our partners. And so just one kind of exciting fact, you know, we ourselves have planted more than 60 million trees around the country. So we're not just encouraging other people to do this work of caring for our forests, but we're out there doing it ourselves. And so we're trying to be leaders in taking what we're learning from climate science, connecting it into how we undertake work like replanting forests, but making sure that we're doing it in a way that will create healthy and resilient forests now and into the future and a changing climate. And then making sure that all the other folks doing that same work have this same information about how to create resilient forests for the future. And then the third component of our work, and we think the third component for getting to real success, is policy. That, you know, public policy is how we take good things and we scale them up. So whether it's the resources that the U.S. Forest Service needs to care for 193 million acres of our forests, or whether it's the information and incentives that we need to give private landowners to take care of forests in the right ways, public policy can make that happen. And so we really try to take what we've learned from science and what we've then translated that into out in the field through forestry and bring that here to Washington, D.C., to state capitals, to mayor's offices, and explain to them what they need to invest in and what they need to make happen through, in some cases, forestry regulations and tree care ordinances in cities and other kinds of regulatory measures as well. And then the last thing I'll say about the work of American Forests, which I think is really important, is that we've been very effective at bringing new kinds of financial resources to the table to leverage the investment that we're asking for from government. And in particular, we've managed to find over 200 corporate partners around America and around the world who have partnered with us in funding reforestation here in the U.S. And around the world. And so we've done projects in all 50 states and 40 countries working with these corporate partners. And so they are providing matching money for the money that governments are putting up for things like replanting our national forests and planting more trees in city parks and along city streets. And so we're just really proud of that kind of new money that we've been able to create for this important work through corporate partnerships and think that those companies really deserve a lot of credit for having stepped up to the plate and being key partners and taking care of America's forests.
And when I prepare for the show and when we're doing production or deciding who we want to interview and what's the relationship with your mission to what we're doing. And of course, ours is all about climate change and raising awareness with mainstream America about the need for engagement. A couple of things struck me, and you hit them. One of them is the history of leadership. And I was honestly sitting there saying, how come you are so late to this party, Gina? I have been doing this work passionately for 12 years. And I had no idea of the magnitude and scope of what your organization does, and I say that from my heart, and that you're the oldest national conservation organization in the United States. And when I say that it's like a perfect storm of what you're doing, one of the most important things you mentioned about the work you're doing, and we'll go into it in a little bit more detail, is the collaborative work, because we have a joke on our team that we mean, it's, you know, teamwork makes the dream work. Well, it's going to take a really big team to turn this ship around, to change the trajectory in which we're headed. And it was another thing that just struck me. You are a leader in the collaborative process. And I said, we'll talk about that. And I don't even know if you can answer this, but there are so many competing priorities around out there. And I want to go into depth about a blog you wrote in Huffington Post in 2017, because it's so relevant today, right now. But as an organization that has, you know, statewide, global, regional, national impact, how do you go about establishing priorities given the needs are so vast? Can you even answer that question? Is that even a fair question to ask you?
It's a fair question, and I can't wait to answer it. But I want to thank you for noticing our leadership role and our history. As you said, we are the first forest conservation organization created in America. We were founded in 1875, and we predate the U.S. Forest Service by 30 years.
It
we actually
blows me
led
away.
The charge to create the U.S. Forest Service in 1905. The legislation to establish the U.S. Forest Service was passed 4 weeks after an event that we hosted in 1905 called the Second American Forest Congress. And it ties into the other point that you made, that we haven't just been around a long time, but our hallmark for 144 years has not been, hey, we'll get out of our way, we're going to do this ourselves. It's how do we rally everyone together, public sector organizations, private sector organizations, citizens, to identify what we need to do for our forests and then take that action. And these American Forest Congresses that we've hosted throughout our history, including this one in 1905, have been an example, great example of that servant leadership and convening role of this organization. And when we do that well, amazing things happen, like the creation of the U.S. Forest Service, which has been a gift that keeps on giving for everyone doing work with forests in America. But let me talk about that question of priorities, because it's one that we talk about every day at American Forest, and it really has defined the work that we have done here since I came on board about 2 years ago.
If you don't mind, I never do this. I hope I never do this, but I would like to just have you elaborate even a little bit more on the history, because you are right, it's so important. Let's give people a sense of time. That was right after the Civil War. It was a time of tremendous development, industrial expansion. Forests were being clear cut. Yeah. Oh, it's time for the railroad. Oh, we need to have new farms. Oh, we're, you know, doing the West. And to me, when I did go down that rabbit hole, not only did you change that by starting, maybe putting the brakes on it, what just thrilled me is the way that it was proposed. You weren't opposed to progress, but, and I quote from the website, you advocated for a careful and science-based strategy. Who was talking about that in the 1800s? Raise your hand.
Right? That sounds like... Yeah, how much more modern can you get than that, right?
I know. So I just wanted to, I didn't
say,
want to
you know,
go.
All I have to do. All I need to do as the 40th president of American Forest is doing a great job of looking back in our history and remembering our best ideas and bringing into the present. Because, you know, I think you're right. I mean, for that whole history, we've been on this, bringing together science and forestry and policy and figuring out really strong solutions that are, I like to say, radically centrist. You know, they're just something that they're just common sense, they're rooted in science, or something that everyone can participate in and using that to galvanize action. And so I'm glad that you invited me to linger a little bit on our history, because I, it's both really important for people to understand who care about our forests. How did we get to this point today? And I think understanding what we need to do now can really be informed by our history. So just a few other markers in our history. You know, the first American Forest Congress, which was also the first ever National Arbor Day, we hosted in 1882, 7 years after a small group of citizens came together and came up with the idea for what was then called the American Forestry Association. Actually, that was our original name. And when that first group of citizens came together, it was exactly as you said. It was in response to the fact that we were damaging our forests potentially beyond repair. And if we kept, you know, using our forests in an unsustainable way, you know, water supplies were starting to be fouled, and I think, you know, wildfires were raging out of control, and there was a sense that we were really going to kill this green goose that lays this golden egg of all the things that forests do for us. So here's a number that you'll find pretty incredible. That event in 1882, we drew together 50,000 people from around the country in 1882. As you pointed out, shortly after the Civil War, they weren't coming there in Teslas, I can tell you that much, right? Think about what it took, like, to get 50,000 people together for anything from around this country in 1882. But the way I like to think about it is, you know, wow, Americans really showed up for their forests against all odds in that instance, and have kept showing up for forests ever since. So that first event in 1882 was really the catalyst for this wake-up moment for America. And then we've had these stepping stones of progress. So in 1905, Second American Forest Congress, you know, we created the U.S. Forest Service. We created the National Forest System as well around that time. So real bedrock. 6 years later, our organization led the charge to pass the Weeks Act. The Weeks Act of 1911 was what created the Eastern National Forest. So the Western National Forests were all cookie-cuttered out of land that the federal government had bought, you know, en masse, things like the Louisiana Purchase. The Eastern National Forest basically had to be bought back in many cases from private landowners, and that was a real undertaking. But the forests of the East were being so damaged, and it was having such an impact on water supplies, that Congress said, hey, you know what, we need to create some reserves in the East, now National Forest, that can protect key things like the drinking water supplies that come to us out of the Appalachian Mountains. And so that was another kind of a signature accomplishment. And then just two others I'll mention. One is that right around that time, so right around the time of World War I, our organization started really ramping up discussion of trees in cities. And we actually started doing memorial tree plantings. In fact, I have a trowel in my office that Ms. Warren G. Harding, the first lady, used to do memorial tree plantings here in Washington, D.C. And the idea of planting trees in cities was kind of an aha moment for people that, hey, you know, we should have the benefits of trees and forests everywhere, not just out there in the mountains. And so for our whole history, but really starting most in earnest there around that same time, you know, we've been saying it's healthy and resilient forests from cities to wilderness. We need to invest in them across that whole spectrum of places. We need to value them for the diverse things that they do for us in those different settings. And then throughout that history, we've both been doing the work ourselves with the tree planting, for example, that I described. We've been putting in place these cornerstone forestry laws that have been what give us the public money and the kind of regulatory structure to take care of our forests in the right way. And so as that brings us up to the present moment, I think there's a really important paradigm shift that I personally think is really important, and this organization does too, which is that, you know, back when we were founded, people were the problem. You know, we were doing a bad job of taking care of our forests. And so the problems that we faced were in many cases of our own making. And here in the United States, we have totally flipped that script. You know, we have the incredible standards of sustainable forest practices here in the United States that are the envy of the world. We're taking good care of our forests from private lands to public lands. Yes, there are things that we need to improve in some areas, particularly in terms of investing more resources in some of our public land management. So we're more actively taking care of them around issues like wildfire. But in general, you know, when we intervene in forests with forestry, we make forests better, we make them healthier. And And so really the paradigm shift is to think about climate change and the stress that climate change is putting on our problems. That's the enemy here. It's not us. It's how do we all together, in the way that we're caring for our forests, understand this new tsunami of forest health threats coming at us, being pushed by climate change, and position everyone from the person taking care of trees in their backyard, to the mayor, to the state official, to the folks taking care of our national forests, private landowners. How do we position everyone for success in managing our forests to be healthy and resilient in the face of these kinds of challenges? And what we just haven't talked about much yet, but should really make sure we get to in depth in this conversation today, is in the process of keeping our forests healthy during climate change, take advantage of the incredible power they have to slow climate change by pulling carbon dioxide out of the air.
And let's just do that, because my journey began, I was corporate America all the way. Had a national company, traveled a lot on airplanes, which is a story for another day. I still fly on airplanes. Not really living totally unconsciously, but not in any way aware of those brilliant forefathers that founded American forests, of the severity of the trajectory, for lack of a better phrase. And I went to the Amazon rainforest on a very sacred and very special trip with someone connected to a tribe there. So it wasn't like your Ritz-Carlton on the river. It was like, I was scared stiff, to be honest. I'm like sleeping in the jungle by myself with, netting around me thinking, what are you doing? And Jad, that is when I learned from some medicine men and some westernized thought leaders that were there, people from National Geographic, our forests are like, it's the thing. The impact on our oxygen supply, on cooling the oceans, on wildlife habitat, the list goes on. So let's talk about that. Why are forests so important? Not so important, that's so not enough. Essential, critical to our survival.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and so this kind of gets us back to that conversation about priorities, right? The question that you had asked earlier. And I sometimes think that one of the challenges actually in talking about forests is that there are so many reasons why they're vital for our survival that by the time we get halfway down the list, people's eyes glaze over and they kind of lose track of it, or they think, that sounds too good to be true, right? And so we made a conscious decision when I came to American Forest that we wanted to lock in on four key priority issues that we think really define why our forests are most important right now and shape kind of the actions that we need to take in our forests and the values that we think are most at risk in our forests if we don't take the right actions. And so the four values are the capacity of forests to help us respond to climate change, both protecting us from climate change and powerfully slowing climate change down. And just the one number I want to say now, and I'm going to say it at least five more times so everybody memorizes it, is that U.S. forests and forest products to capture and store almost 15% of our carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuels every year here in the United States. Almost 15% of our emissions captured in our forests and forest products. That's today. So a lot of times people say, oh, I wonder if we can use forests as a climate change solution. We all say, hey, wait, time out. They already are a huge climate change solution here in the U.S. Let's not skip over that part. And so the context here yes, we need to protect forests from the incredible stress that climate change is putting on them, because if they're dying and burning, they're not going to be able to help us by capturing and storing carbon. But if we can keep them healthy, that 15% has capacity to almost double to 27 to 30% by our calculations, and those are consistent with what you'll find from other leading science-based organizations, both public and private, as well. So as much as we're getting now from forests, it could be even dramatically more if we make the right investments, like planting more forests and like helping to deal with our wildfire crisis and things like that. The second priority issue that we're really focused on is people, but most specifically, equity, and how we make sure that all people are enjoying the benefits of forests equitably. And we're in cities particularly focused on a concept that we call tree equity, which just takes head on the fact that the benefits of trees in cities are significantly concentrated in wealthy neighborhoods. If I show you a map of tree canopy of virtually any city in America, I'm essentially showing you a map of income. And in some cases, I'm actually even showing you a map of race in ways that transcends income. So there's a vast tree inequity in this country, and that has huge consequences for people. For example, neighborhoods that don't have trees heat up more during heat waves, and more people die in heat waves in those neighborhoods that don't have trees. We have ample evidence of that from scientific research. Trees play a critical role in cities of pulling air pollution and trapping air pollution off of city streets and out of people's neighborhoods. Again, a critical issue to distribute, a critical service to distribute equitably across our neighborhoods. And when you think about the irony that we know from research that air pollution levels are generally higher in low-income neighborhoods and communities of color, and yet they have less of this air purification benefit that we're getting from city trees. You can just start to see the moral imperative to fix this. This is life-giving infrastructure. Urban trees are life-giving infrastructure that we need to distribute equitably across our cities. And so we're using this rallying cry, this vision for tree equity, to point out these inequities and then say, let's think about trees from what people need from them and making sure that all people have those benefits of trees, especially in cities. But we're also thinking about another key dimension of people and equity, which is the incredible capacity of our forests to create job opportunities for the people who need them the most. So there are over 2.5 million jobs in the forest sector right now, and that's a number that surprises a lot of people. Forests are a big part of the U.S. economy, but there's also immense potential for growth. Now, for example, if we're going to mobilize urban forests as a climate change solution by planting lots and lots more forests in rural communities, that's going to create job opportunities in one part of America that really needs them the most. A lot of rural communities are still really economically struggling since the 2008 recession. And so if we can ramp up how we care for our forests and planting forests across our rural forest landscapes, that's a huge opportunity to create new green jobs in rural communities that really need them. But similarly in cities, you know, the places where we're worried about tree equity, the underserved neighborhoods that don't have enough trees in cities are also economically underserved. And so there's a huge opportunity for us to use forests and forest employment as a way to address the economic needs of those communities at the same time that we're helping to improve the environment in these neighborhoods by planting more trees. And so we have created a whole career pathways initiative working with a great range of partners to identify new techniques to link low-income people in these neighborhoods into urban forestry careers, both within their neighborhoods but all across the cities where they live. And then the two other things that we focus on are the most familiar probably for folks thinking about why invest in forests, why conserve forests, and the next of those is water. The fact that over half of the drinking water in America comes from our forests. It's collected and filtered by our forests like a green sponge is the way I like to think about the role that forests play. And they collect that water, they filter it, they serve it back to us in a more regulated way. And so the role of forests in acting as that reservoir for us, that green sponge for our water supplies, is more important than ever, particularly in a changing climate. When we know that in some places, like California, for example, extended drought is stressing our water supplies. And so having a well-regulated natural system for holding snowpack and releasing that water in a measured way is really, really important in those places where there's a lot more variability in water supplies and will only become more so in the future. And then the last, the fourth of our priority issues is wildlife. And again, another really familiar issue for folks thinking about forest conservation and restoration throughout our history. But what isn't common and is new is that we face a biodiversity crisis nationally and globally at a scale that we've never seen before. And there's incredible new research that's come out in the last few months documenting just how profound that loss of biodiversity is across the country and the world, you know, loss of species at an incredible rate. And so when you think about how can we sustain species like the ocelot and the grizzly bear and other what we call habitat specialists, species that are dependent on a particular type of forest that provides food supply and shelter that they, you know, that they're not able to just transition to some other type of forest. The ocelot, for example, is really dependent on a very unique forest type in South Texas called a thorn scrub forest, which has been more than 90% of that forest that has been cleared. And so if we want the ocelot, you know, to survive, we have to recreate, we have to replant and restore much, much more of that habitat so that there's a big enough base and a connected enough network of those habitats for the ocelot to den and to be able to move around the landscape, you know, through forests and not having to cross too many roads where they're often hit by cars. And there are many, many other examples around the country where there's some wildlife species that survival essentially depends on not just can we, you know, take care of our forests or plant more forests, but can we be targeted enough, science-based enough to understand exactly what their habitat requirements are and use all of our science-based forestry expertise to make sure they get exactly the habitats that they need.
So after doing this work for me every day for 10 years, you're bringing up things that nobody ever talked to me about. Nobody. And I've had really big organizations, small organizations, local, national, international. Nobody has ever talked to me about tree equity. And I talk about, and we've had guests on the show, about the impact of climate change hitting marginalized community first, hardest, longest lasting, you know, and that is all true. So what I would like to know, people love stories, and this is an amazing story in and of itself, but of all the work you're doing for you, Jad Daly, right now, do you have one or two stories that are examples of your work in action that just say, oh my gosh, Gina, we did this and, you know, how awesome it was and we're all celebrating. Do you have a favorite story or two that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I'm going to get in trouble with my staff if I pick between all the amazing things you're doing, but I'm going to do that anyway. How's that?
Tell them to forgive you and that
I tell anyone, please.
I tell them I promise that you can come back.
Yeah, it's our little secret, right?
Right.
So let me talk about, if it's okay, I have a couple examples I'd love to
use. Yes.
And the first is I want to focus. I think you know we've talked about this a little bit. We're sort of edging towards it, but I want to talk about it very explicitly. What I like to call the geeky forestry details of sustaining our forests in a changing climate. How with the amount of climate change that we're seeing. And we know that forests are good at a lot of things, but you know they don't tend to move around real well, and they don't tend to adapt that well either. And so you know our forests are really being stretched outside of their comfort zone by this rapid climate change, and so it's really challenging us to step up the rigor with which we try to puzzle out the solutions of how we have to adjust in some cases these forests. To survive into the future. And so just a couple of examples that I'm really particularly proud of. One is in California. Folks may not know this, but there's an incredible tragic story that's playing out in California. 148 million trees have died in California just since 2010 alone. If I showed you a map of the state, you could hardly believe how extensive that tree death has been. And there's very strong science that shows that tree death has been driven by climate change in California and how rapidly it's playing out, things like this unprecedented drought that California is facing right now. And so the scientists that we're working with from the USDA Climate Hub and University of California, Davis, and others have told us we might have as little as 10 years to figure out in some of these high mortality areas how to essentially restructure these forests so that they can survive in this climate that's changing all around them. And so just back in January, we hired a new California state director, a woman, Brittany Dyer, who's the co-chair of the state of California's Tree Mortality Task Force. And so she's been studying this issue and on top of this issue for a long time. And we said, we really want you to come in and dive into the worst of these mortality areas, which happens to be the Southern Sierra, where you have very famous places like Sequoia National Park, Yosemite National Park, some of the most famed public lands that probably your listeners can picture in their heads. And these are the places where our forests are dying at this unprecedented rate. And most often after they die, at some point when those trees finally fall to the ground, they're now fuel for levels of wildfire that we've never seen before. And so Brittany was brave enough to take on the challenge for us of saying, how do we step into the middle of all these players, the National Park Service, the Forest Service, the state of California, tribal foresters, private landowners, and bring the science to the table to help everyone figure out what to do. But the key thing is that we don't have time to just, you know, kind of do tiny experiments and then sit back for 10 years and watch. We have to start doing, you know, using the best information that we have and getting to work right now and set up the system to essentially learn as we go. And so it's a fascinating example of, you know, the kind of innovation and experimentation that we have to be ready for to help our forests weather climate change. And so what Brittany is doing is with all these partners, essentially setting up a set of kind of controlled experiments where we're going to be implementing forest restoration across this landscape, both thinning, you know, some of these diseased forests and dying forests, but also replanting forests where they've been lost at a much faster rate. And in the process, using climate science to try kind of different shades of change, all the way from a little bit different from how we've done it in the past, all the way to really dramatic change from how we might have restored a forest like that. We call it pre-storing these forests for a changing climate. And so the way that effort is coming together, all these incredible organizations being willing to partner together and take the time to figure this out, is something that I'm really proud of. And then a kind of a parallel example is in South Texas. I talked about this really exciting effort that we're leading with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and great organizations like the Nature Conservancy and the Conservation Fund, and then incredible local organizations like Friends of the Wildlife Corridor, all coming together to say, you know, we've done a good job starting to put back in place, you know, replant this thorn scrub habitat for the ocelot, for the more than 500 species of birds that use this incredibly rich, biologically rich forest type, more than 300 species of butterflies. And we're talking about, we're replacing the Garden of Eden, essentially, in South Texas, and we've been replanting it as fast as we can. American forest has replanted over 2 million trees in this landscape. Over two-thirds of all the trees have been replanted there, but it's not fast enough and it's not enough. And so over the last year, we've pulled all these organizations together and said, we need a new partnership where we all work together to figure out how to do this work much more strategically and much faster. And so this new partnership's come together. It's created a new conservation plan for how to restore these forests more effectively. And we secured a grant over this past summer to start experimenting with climate resilient planting techniques, figuring out how can we replant thorn scrub forests that can actually survive where they're going to be even hotter and drier years ahead in South Texas. So it's really another example of scaling up, but also saying, how do we get that climate science really integrated deeply into the work that we're doing so that we're demonstrating for the country and for the world what success is going to look like.
So each one of these are buckets in themselves that I could go down another rabbit hole on each one of them, but I really want to encourage people to read your blog, which is a treasure trove, the one that you wrote on December 23rd, 2017. A link will be on the page when your show is put out there. But all that you said has to be couched in your observation there in that blog about hitting a moving target. There was business as usual, and there were plans and systems being put in place. And now we have something called the erratic behavior of climate change. And you know, you're such a good writer and say things that, you know, kind of make people laugh about, you know, how do we play tennis in a gale force wind, as you say, with targets constantly moving, sometimes at the last minute, and how do you stay nimble on your feet? So you have big initiatives in place, making an impact, and then bam, a forest works, you know, its way, a forest fire works its way through 563,000 acres, which is what happened to us in Arizona with the Wallow Fire. What is, what are you, like, what is your organization? Is it gather the troops, you know, roll up the mattresses, come into the office, and we have to figure out this priority? How do you, as a leader in this movement of conservation, how do you work with the moving targets?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a fantastic question. And if it's okay, at some point before we're done, I would love to circle back. I just wanted to give you a particular success story from our tree equity work, because we're very consistent and intentional about really thinking with equal balance about our passion and our ambitions for urban forests, as well as the couple landscape examples that I gave you. So at some point, maybe we can circle back to that. But
absolutely.
But to talk about for a moment this question of how do we deal with the fact that even our best efforts can be undone, right? When we're working on these large landscapes, we can orchestrate partnerships, we can get everyone doing the right thing, but the scale of stress that we're facing right now from something like wildfire, you're absolutely right. It can overwhelm our best efforts. And so I think what you said was right on target. You know, instead of doing projects or even, protecting or restoring landscapes, we have to build systems. That's really the moment where we are right now. We have to build systems that have redundancy in them. And so that's why shameless self-promotion here, another piece that we wrote was on the vision to reforest America, which is a call to scale up reforestation like the work I described in the Lower Rio Grande to a completely different scale than we've talked about in the past. 3 billion trees or more in the next 10 years, which is what we did during the original New Deal. We planted 3 billion trees over 10 years, an overlooked component of what the CCC did during the New Deal. We did another moment like that. And one of the reasons that we need to do that is that we need redundancy in the system. We need to assume that we're going to lose forests as we go. And so everything we do in our forests has to assume that in some places, even if we do all the right things, we're not going to get the result that we want. And so therefore, we need to do the right things at a much grander scale than we thought. We need a bigger margin of error, if you will, in scaling up everything we're doing, from reforestation to the forest that we're investing in, wildfire management and pest and disease management, and other kinds of activity. So I think that, for us, as when we think about our work at American Forest, we actually divide it into three modes of operation. We have an organizational impact model, and it's we call our innovation lab, which is where we're essentially cooking up, working with scientists to figure out what to do, and cooking up tools and resources that we and others can use to get this work right. We have a place-based mode to our work, and I gave you a couple examples in Texas and California of, okay, so we need to go out and be doers. We have to lead by example. But then the third mode for us is movement building. And I think movement building is where we can create those systems and create redundancy. So how with public policy and how through leading coalitions can we help make enough things happen across the country? So it's not just about what American Forest does and touches, but American Forest is a true servant leader that helps everybody pull the rope on getting this right. And so when we're talking to Congress, for example, here at the federal level, we're saying, look, this is the scale of challenge we're facing. You need to provide resources to your own federal agencies, to states, to local governments, to private sector partners and landowners and grants, so that we can all go out there and do enough of this work that we can lose a few and still be successful in the overall our overall goals, like using forests to slow climate change, like potentially doubling from 15% to 30%, the amount of climate protection we could be getting from our forests.
So let's go back to the tree equity issue, because I love that. I mean, people say to me when I'm having certain guests on, and it's really a social justice issue, what does climate change have to do with social justice? And it's one of the four legs for us. It's like everything. You got to be kidding me. Climate change is a social justice issue. So I'd love for you to talk about tree equity and a great story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the only reason that we put climate change first in that list of four is that we see it as the gateway to the other three values of people, water, and wildlife, right? If we can't address climate change, it's going to undermine our success in serving people, in serving, in protecting our water and in protecting wildlife. So it's just kind of a threshold issue. And, you know, we were speaking earlier about the ways in which climate change is creating unprecedented threats to people in cities. So I want to just provide a little bit of context there before talking about example of success. People may not know this. You know, in the Chicago heat wave of 1995, which was the worst modern here in the U.S., the worst loss of life in a heat wave in modern times, more than 700 people died in that event over just a period of just a few days. And they did research afterwards, and they found, you know, statistically clear that more people died in areas without enough tree cover and that create that kind of oven-like effect that we call an urban heat island. So they took this incredibly dangerous, life-threatening heat wave, and they actually made it worse on the people in these neighborhoods. But the neighborhoods that didn't have trees and also had low-income people who might not have air conditioning, couldn't just go to a hotel or leave town, are more likely to have pre-existing health conditions, are more likely to live in a house that doesn't have good cross ventilation, right? That who have structural increase in their vulnerability to something like a heat wave. Well, they're the very people who are getting the least protection. And so again, we just think that's morally insupportable. For us, this isn't cerebral. This is ethical. This is a moral issue, and we really think it's a moral failing that we're not recognizing that this substantial health risk that is being presented to people from heat, the fact that it is being exacerbated by climate change, and the fact that we have ready to go solutions like planting more trees in these neighborhoods and to create tree equity for them and create this climate protection, and we're not doing it. There was one study, in fact, I should mention from the Rollins School of Public Health that projected a tenfold increase in heat-related death in eastern cities just by the middle of the century. So, you know, to the degree that, so the Chicago gave you one example, and there are others that have occurred, but that is going to get a whole lot worse in the future. And so this, the urgency of tree equity for protecting people's health is only going to grow over time. But here's a story that I want to tell, which is just, I think it kind of encapsulates what this movement is about. Wilmington, Delaware has been a particular leader on this issue of tree equity, and so we have been partnering there in Wilmington with the city of Wilmington, with a fabulous local organization, the Delaware Horticultural Society, and with other local organizations as well, and with J.P. Morgan Chase as one of those corporate partners that I mentioned that is bought into this idea of tree equity, that really believe that tree equity aligns with their values for inclusive growth and environmental sustainability and our values at American Forest for what's driving our interest in tree equity. And so we recently brought together one of our planting events in Wilmington. And so if you can just imagine this scene, we had this incredible diversity of folks there. We had over 50 volunteers from J.P. Morgan Chase taking the day to come help us plant trees in a significantly underserved part of Wilmington that's also underserved in terms of trees. We had a group there called Branches to Chances, which is a program of the Delaware Horticultural Society. And this is a program that takes folks who are coming out of incarceration and helps give them training so they can transition into the thousands of open positions in cities like Wilmington and all around the country, doing this work of planting trees and taking care of trees and creating tree equity. So we had, those folks side by side, and we had other folks from different community groups. But the moment for me that captured what this is all about is there was a woman probably in her early 80s from the neighborhood, and when we were just kind of getting things organized in the morning, she came out, she grabbed me by the elbow, and she said, "Let's take a walk." And so we went out, and I said, "Great." And so we started to take a walk, and she said, "My name is Miss Green, and I want to tell you about my neighborhood." And so we started to talk, and she told me about the things that were going on and concerns that people had in the neighborhood, concerns she had, when she walks out the door every day. And she turned to me and she said, you know, this is how we're going to get it right, is with partnerships. And she said, you know, I take this as a real act of love that you people are here today. And she said, you know, it would be okay if I come work with you side by side, if I come plant with you today, because these are going to be my trees. You know, this is my neighborhood, and that's going to be an important part of my neighborhood, and I want to be part of this. And I said, you better believe it. You know, we're going to work side by side, the two of us. And so we did. You know, we spent the whole day working side by side, and you know, this woman outworked, you know, most people there. I'll tell you, she was really amazing, and would occasionally break into song and you know, entertain folks, and there was just, she brought this incredible spirit. But as I was talking to people afterwards, you know, about why this event meant so much to us, it kind of encapsulated everything in terms of, you know, Miss Green is the person we think about when we think, who needs tree equity, who needs protection, you know, lower income folks, elderly folks, folks who have these structural vulnerabilities to things like heat and air pollution I talked about earlier. Who needs those jobs? Well, it's the Americans who are coming out of incarceration at incredibly high rates now and are trying to figure out what's next. And there's jobs waiting for them in urban forestry if we can do a good job of making the connection. And it's about everybody pulling the rope. And so the fact that JP Morgan Chase, you know, a company that has the kind of values that it saw the soul of this effort, and wanted to align itself with this effort, with a nonprofit organization and a city, to do something like this. And you had, you know, the mayor of Wilmington, there, you know, putting his personal time and stamp into the fact that this really matters. This isn't, you know, just a tree planting event for our city. This really matters. And so I think, you know, that's what success looks like. We're going to create tree equity if we can rally that kind of a broad-based support and create that much value for this country out of doing this work.
And talk about wanting to do the happy dance. If this was videotaped, I'd be doing the happy dance, because there is just no downside to that story. It's all about what's right about the world and will make such a difference. And there are some good initiatives in our city, too. Our mayor has a goal to plant 1 million trees, and we have an organization called Tucson Clean and Beautiful that is doing all of that. And I think when you're taking the deeper cut of, if I want a tree or trees for my yard, I go to the nursery and I buy them. That isn't the case for so many people. It's like, what's the big deal? Go plant a tree. Well, it is a really big deal if it's going to be a decision between diapers or food or gas for the car and planting a tree. And it's that real. I mean, the disparity in abilities to do that, having had a 35-year career in the social services, I can tell you the struggle is real. That's just not something I made up. So the grin on my face is sincerely from ear to ear. So the challenge for me now is the limited time we have left, which always makes me sad. A couple of the bigger questions I wanted to ask you and not leave anything out. But there's two that I'd like to to kind of just talk about a little bit. One of the things in your blog was about an incredible gift of $165 million from a couple to conserve a vast area of the California coastline covering 38 square miles. That is no small gift. It's stunning. And without knowing all that entails, it's got to be complicated. These are uncertain times. Let's just be honest. There are mixed signals from the federal government, to say the least, and even some states about how government agencies will approach conservation and whether or not climate change is even a part of that conversation. So how does that complicate things for you, or does it? What are you seeing?
You know, it's funny. I surprise people when I answer that question, which is I feel a lot of hope, and I see a lot of promise in this moment. I want to give a couple of examples. So the first is the leadership from the city level and from the state level.
Yes.
You mentioned fantastic 1 million tree pledge from the city of Tucson, right? That's, you know, that is an incredible statement. Talk about tree equity, right? That's a chance to plant a whole lot of tree equity in a place that's uniquely vulnerable to heat, to air pollution, some of the challenges that I talked about. Across the country, very different place. Miami, Dade County, one of our key partners, has made a million tree pledge. So we see from the, and many, many other cities as well that have really gone big on Detroit and others that we work with that have really made incredible commitments to urban forestry and are backing them up with resources and people's time. The state level, one of our partners is the U.S. Climate Alliance, which is a group of 24 states. It was originally founded by Governor Jerry Brown and Governor Inslee of Washington and Governor Cuomo of New York. And they brought together a group of states, it's now grown to 24, that have pledged to uphold their part of the Paris Climate Accord, you know, whether or not the federal government does. And so they are in the process, we are helping them do this, of creating incredibly ambitious plans to act on climate change and at a scale we've, in some cases, never seen before. And they're including forests as a big part of the puzzle. Which is how we ended up as a partner in this effort with these states. And we're hosting learning labs, for example, so they can come together with experts in the forestry field and learn, you know, where are there opportunities for each of these states to capture and store more carbon in their forests and keep their forests healthy in a changing climate. And New York State, one of those Climate Alliance members, just, you know, a few days ago passed one of the farthest reaching, if not the farthest reaching, state level climate legislation ever enacted. I mean, right there at the same level as states like California and Hawaii. So huge hope at the state level. But here's the one that might really surprise you. We think there's incredible hope at the federal level, and much like an estuary where, you know, the water at the surface runs one direction, but underneath it's going a different direction. We think that's what's happening here at the federal level. If you just follow the papers, what you see in here in the mainstream media, you know, you might feel hopeless about whether we can ever get political consensus on, for example, acting on climate change and using forests as part of that. But we see a very, very different picture when we walk over to Capitol Hill, when we talk to folks in the current administration, for example, within the U.S. Forest Service. We see a lot of progress in terms of gaining consensus, in some cases quietly, in some cases in terms of brand new legislation that's being introduced, in some cases in terms of increased appropriations for important programs. But we feel like what's happening is a kind of a building up of a big snapback that's going to occur, regardless of the results of the next presidential election, that there's just so much pent-up understanding politically at the federal level that we have to do something, and that, you know what, land is a great place to start. Forests are a great place to start. So we're expecting tremendous progress on climate change, both in our piece of it and overall, much more quickly than people would expect at the federal level. And I'll just give you a tiny micro example of that. Yesterday, actually, the U.S. House of Representatives approved a 30% increase for the Urban and Community Forestry Program that's helping us create tree equity across America. And that's a program that's been stuck at the same level for forever. And when folks in Congress were presented with the things we've been talking about today, the fact that this is literally life and death infrastructure for people in underserved neighborhoods to get the benefit of trees, they stepped up and they made Congress's, at least the U.S. House so far, which finished the process, but's proposing a really, really substantial increase in the money that we will have to spend across the country, all of us, to create tree equity. So I think those are just, that's a tiny sign of what I think is a building wave of leadership at the federal, state, and local level. And I think the private sector is there now, is leading now, and is ready to take hand in hand with government leadership and make this happen.
And I could not agree with you more about seeing the cities and states stepping up in really significant ways. It's their home. It's their territory. It's their constituency. So I do see on that landscape some hope. So my last question, because I was going to ask you about, you know, what is American Forest working on that gives you hope? Well, you answered a lot of that, and it gives me hope for a brighter future for our country and for our planet, and I'm sure it will for our thousands of listeners. It's very, very encouraging. So, but I do want to ask you this question. You can say, you know what, Gina, let's just go by that and we'll end on an up note, but it's really not a politically charged question, and I say that sincerely. With the next presidential race coming up, just warming up, in my opinion, climate change, which should definitely be party neutral, What would you have to say in your leadership role to the candidates about the importance of weaving climate change into almost every one of their conversation? How would you help them map out the future of our forests and our preserving our natural habitats, greening our cities? Because we didn't even get a chance to talk about the priority of greening our cities, but you know, preserving other natural areas. What would you get to say if you had your day on the stage?
Yeah, well, and let me say, by the way, that, you know, our vision for tree equity is inclusive of all aspects of greening cities. And so it, you know,
yes.
the vision for tree equity really, you know, while it is driven by bringing urban tree cover to the places that need it the most, neighborhoods that are underserved in many ways, including in trees. The way we accomplish that is by helping cities build urban forestry programs that can take care of all of it, including the big, beautiful forest that they have in parks and other areas that aren't underserved in terms of trees. And so I think that when cities do it the right way, we can have it all. We can have that, you know, broad urban greening effect, but make sure that when we do that, we really start by targeting those places that are most underserved in terms of tree canopy cover. But you know, we are actually speaking with and working with you know, presidential candidates who have asked our advice on what we think they how we think they should integrate forests into their platforms, and particularly that interest from the candidates has been driven significantly by how they're thinking about climate change, and they're really understanding forests, you know, and the role that they can play in addressing climate change. And so, you know, we wrote a piece, we have a piece in The Hill this week that was written in the context of the Democratic presidential debates over the next couple of days. And I co-authored this piece with Robert Bonney, who's currently at Duke University, but in the Obama administration, he was the Undersecretary for Natural Resources and the Environment. So he was overseeing the U.S. Forest Service and the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Really much the most pivotal role for the work that we're doing at USDA during the Obama administration. So we co-authored a piece where we laid out the need to put forests to work on climate change, and it really kind of maps out systematically all the things that we need the federal government to invest in. Invest in reforestation, invest in, you know, for example, more thinning of fire-prone forests, invest in wood products and utilization of wood products. We haven't talked too much about this, but wood products store over 100 million metric tons of carbon every single year. About 15% of our overall carbon capture in our forests is actually the carbon that's stored in wood. And so there's a lot that the federal government can do with policy and different kinds of incentive programs and research to actually ramp up the way that we use wood, as the environmentally sustainable building material of the future is actually the one we've had all along. And so there are huge opportunities there. There are opportunities for the federal government to invest in tree equity at a whole different magnitude than the small win that I described earlier that we seem to have here in the appropriations process this year. And there's a critical opportunity for the federal government to invest in workforce development. You know, the Green New Deal, it's really a shame that concept started to kind of take on a lot of baggage, because the core idea behind the Green New Deal, let's strip away the label. The idea behind the Green New Deal is that we need to invest in climate action that aligns with our goals for equity and aligns with our goals for job creation, which is, of course, a dimension of equity. And so we often say, geez, if you want climate action that advances equity, including green job opportunities for the people that need them the most, you pretty much can't do better than forests. I mean, I was describing earlier the ways that we can actually target these actions in ways that not only advance acting on climate, but that target jobs to the rural communities and urban areas that need them the most. And so when you put that whole package together, there's an incredible opportunity for the candidates or President Trump, if he is reelected, to say, hey, here's a real opportunity to act on climate change in a way that has so many co-benefits and has so much natural appeal for people. I jokingly said in one tweet, we should build a bridge, a bipartisan bridge to act on climate out of wood. that's this is the way that we're We're going to get that done. So I do invite folks to find that piece online, and there's another piece that I wrote in the Hill on talking about forest and the Green New Deal in similar terms, and that kind of lay out some of these arguments. But I'll close with this, and we've talked about this with candidates. You know, no one knows the New Deal better than us. I have a pen across my office here that was used by President Roosevelt to sign the bill that created the Civilian Conservation Corps in the early 1930s. And the Civilian Conservation Corps, the idea for it came in part by our organization from our experience after World War I doing recovery work, including planting war gardens and helping to replant forests that had been damaged by World War I. And so for, 10, 15 years after World War I, we said, hey, wow, this is urgently needed work, including here in America, where we hadn't had lost forests to war, but we were losing forests for other reasons. And this is a great way to become a stronger country and put people back to work at a stress time for this country. And so we helped advocate to create the CCC. We made sure that it had a big role for forests. And as I said earlier, during the New Deal, the CCC planted 3 billion trees. And employed over 3 million people, different people, during a 10-year period during which we planted those 3 billion trees, a peak of about 500,000 people in a given year during that 10-year period. So we can do this. We have evidence that we can do it. My gosh, if we could do it, in the 1930s, we should be able to rally the resources and the willpower to do it today. So the last thing I'll say there is we're getting a tremendous reception from the presidential candidates we're talking to about this, but again, also from folks in the current administration, from folks in the Hill. Quietly, I think there's a movement building here that I really do think inevitably we're gonna get there.
And I will ask Kelly to be in touch with Michael, your communications director, to get links to those articles, because our listeners are very dedicated and devoted and care a lot about the planet. And they do the research. They click on links and they care about things like this. And we do everything we can to make it easy to make that very, very easy. You're just one click away. So we'll do that follow-up. So here's how I would like to close with a few words from me. American Forests, with Jad Daly at the helm, is an organization that's leading solutions on climate change. They're engaged in the business of climate smart restoration projects. They are partnering with organizations like Forest Climate Working Group, the nation's only coalition dedicated solely to this issue. American Forests is helping answer the scientific questions that will unlock new forest climate solutions. They're working on restoring native forests, making cities vibrant, advancing forest policy. They're working to protect our water, our wildlife, all of which protects us. And they're leading by example and have been doing this important work for over 144 years. I invite you to learn more about their important work, to even consider supporting their important work, which can be as simple as placing American forests in your estate plans, or to planting trees to commemorate a special occasion, or to honor the memory of a loved one. They have choices for everyone. Why? Why would I make that invitation? Because our lives, and certainly the lives of generations to come, depend on organizations like theirs. Simply put, their work is about our survival as human beings. Jad Daly, thank you for showing up in my world and for all the work you and your team do on our behalf. And to all of our amazing listeners, thanks for being a part of our world. Jad, this was absolutely and positively delightful, and I sincerely thank you.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do, because it really flew. The time flew. So thanks so much. And when I get depressed, I'm going to email you.
And if you ever want to talk again, I will come back and we can do a two-hour show, because this was a lot of fun for me, and just really, really grateful for the chance to talk about this incredibly important work and this incredibly important moment for all of us to come together on these issues. So
and I
really grateful.
I would love to have you back. And we'll put that in the queue because there's going to be more things maybe in the next year that we're going to want updates on. And people love when we have return guests. It's like, where are they now? So yes, I can say that because Kelly and I will partner in making this happen. So once again, thank you. And I hope our paths cross at some conference or some big event in the not too distant future. Thank you.
Thanks again.